Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And as always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever discovered, encountered, been introduced to in my 47 years of doing therapy. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go there and click on the red and white bullseye or the link in the upper left-hand corner that says Start Here, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have either been stepped through that worksheet process and or they've given powerful testimonials about how the application of that tool in their life has actually changed their life for the better. And also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and thereby get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because that frequently leads to comments, questions, testimonials, refutations, soliloquies, etc. And if you have any of those, you can give us a call at 563-999-3581. And when you call that number and press 1, it will put a question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code, and we'd love to have you do that. We're also working through the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. Today is the 265th day of the year, and today's lesson reads, Creation's gentleness is all I see. Commentary reads, I have misunderstood the world because I laid my sins on it and then saw them looking back at me. How fierce they seemed and how deceived I was to think that what I feared was in the world instead of in my mind alone. Today I see the world in the celestial gentleness with which creation shines. There is no fear in it. Let no appearance of my sins obscure the light of heaven shining on the world. What is reflected there is in creation's mind. The images I see reflect my thoughts. Yet is my mind at one with God's, and so I can perceive creation's gentleness. In quiet I would look upon the world, which but reflects your thoughts and mine as well. Let me remember that they are the same, and I will see creation's gentleness. Pam Grout in her Course in Miracles experiment book, Lesson 265, titles it, "Today would be a really good day to forgive somebody, Part 2. And she quotes James Baldwin, who said, "The conquest of the physical world is not man's only duty. He is also enjoined to conquer the great wilderness of himself." Pam writes, "For about a year, I have nursed a grudge against someone who holds a lot of cards in my life. Despite my big talk about working the course, I viewed this, quote, horrible ogre as the one possible exception to the course's request to forgive. In this person's case, I felt oh so justified in hanging on to my story. He really is an unreasonable prig. He really is boring and mean. And OMG, it's just so unfair that I have to endure him every time I want to see this other very special person in my life. My sister and I have spent hours dissecting all the reasons that this person prevents us from really being there for someone we love. After hours of avoiding the inevitable, the voice of the Holy Spirit finally tugged on my pants leg. 'Pam,' it said, 'I've had about enough of this. You are not anything but a poser. How dare you write a book about practicing, about a practice that you're not faithfully practicing?' Well, I didn't like hearing that, but I decided to take lesson 265, Creation's Gentleness is All I See, and take it at its word. I decided to concede that maybe, probably not, but maybe, I misunderstood this person. Maybe I deceived myself. Maybe these judgments are only in my mind. My ego stood resolute, but I was able to give a teensy tiny kernel of willingness. Funny thing, not 30 minutes after throwing up my hands in defeat, this person who hasn't contacted me in a year, quote, even when my very special person was hospitalized, close quotes, sent me a text. We are living in an energetic universe. And when I change my energy, it definitely affects the other people in this universe." So 30 minutes after she gave up her hatred and her bitterness and resentment, or at least softened to the point where she allowed that it might be all in her mind, 30 minutes later, this person who hadn't contacted her in over a year contacted her. So that's our Course in Miracles workbook lesson for today and our Pam Grout commentary. And we have, as usual, about 50 minutes left to talk. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. What is on your mind? What would be useful for you? How could we be of service to you today? By the topic we choose, or helping you work through a worksheet, or helping you understand what a worksheet is and how it can be a powerful tool in your life. Any of these, any and all of these topics would be good for us to explore. And if any of them seems more useful than another to you, we would appreciate hearing that, and we'll focus on that for the rest of our time. We had a support group last night, and in that support group we listened to the explanation of and deep dive into the third line of what's called the Lord's Prayer, but from the ancient Aramaic, so that it is quite a bit different than the King James Version of the Bible English that most people have been exposed to. And it truly is just a meditative experience about opening up to all that life has to offer, and being part of this miracle of creation that is our the truth of our lives. And then we had some discussion, and we had some discussion about creativity, and we had discussion about language. And we talked about Jacob Collier and his tremendous creativity musically, among other things. And if you haven't tapped into it and you want to enjoy some musical creativity, check out Jacob Collier, C-O-L-L-I-E-R, at MIT. Check that out on YouTube, and you won't be disappointed. So lots of other things are going on, and I can talk forever, but it would be more beneficial if somebody raised a hand and said, here, talk about this, or I have a question about this, or I'm struggling with that. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. Yesterday we were talking about some of the concepts in Richard Moss's book and the way he talks about being in the presence moment. The book is Inside Out Healing. And topics in his book include awakening to the power of present moment awareness and understanding the ego's game and causality and creating your own reality. And as we were discussing yesterday, he talks about how in the book, trying to understand the ego's game, this is not attacking my ego. This is not labeling my ego as bad or wrong. This is just understanding that part of my consciousness, that part of my awareness and language formation. He talks about the trap of thinking that I am special, is his word for it, but either better or worse than somebody else. And that the ego has literally created its awareness and its sense of identity by manufacturing the experience, the perception of difference. And whether I think I'm better or worse than somebody, it is a form of imbalance that creates stress, fatigue, and a kind of a dampening of my aliveness. He says, if you're committed to waking up and to healing, then you need to start waking up when your ego pushes you either into the grandiose or the depressive identification of specialness. Because when you come back and realize that we're all the same and you're back in balance, then your perception gets restored. His idea is to give us a choice between being driven by the ego or being aware of its game plan. And the awareness of the game plan frees you from its negative effects, beginning immediately, but then over time it deepens and strengthens. He says, one of the ways that you can know that you're being aware rather than being hijacked by your ego is that when you realize you have fallen into that pattern of specialness, either thinking you are better or worse than another person, you thank yourself for noticing it. You don't busy yourself with beating yourself up. You step right into thanking yourself for the awareness of the process. Rewarding yourself for the awareness is a new idea for most people, he says. But try it. When you catch yourself pulling what your ego would tell you is such a bonehead move and, oh, that's not very highly spiritual of me and, oh, I screwed up again. When you catch those kinds of thoughts, say thank you. Say yes to the awareness and yes to being, the way I like to talk about it, is being gentle with myself. part of this is realizing that my ego, my identification with a sense of self, a certain label, good, bad, or otherwise, is what lots of different spiritual traditions talk about in different ways. Guy Finley calls it a mechanical level of consciousness. It's a thought pattern that just spins every time it gets stirred up, or in Michael Rice's words, resonated. And my ego doesn't understand that it's causing me pain by focusing on negative thoughts and beliefs about me. And so it just keeps doing it. Guy Finley says, the mind doesn't stop when you tell it to stop. The only way, the only time, the only pattern of consequence or circumstance in which the mind stops is when the mind finally realizes that it is the source of its pain, not the solution to it. I just think about the idea of people who want to kill their ego or destroy their ego or do away with their ego or tame their ego. And I think about the Chinese finger trap. I don't know if anybody's seen those. I'm of an age where we used to have these as little party gifts several times a year, and it's it was a woven kind of a reed, kind of a strong tall grass that was woven into a tube, and you would push your fingers in each end of the tube, and then when you tried to pull it out, the weaving would tighten around your fingers, and you'd be trapped. Unless you knew the key, the magic solution. But the more you pull, the tighter the weave gets, and the more you're trapped. The more you resist, the more you're trapped. Well, that's essentially just like trying to kill your ego. The more you try to kill your ego, the stronger your ego gets. How could that be? Well, because the you that wants to kill anything is part of ego. We've talked about it before. One of my favorite books was The Mirror Theory, and in it, at one point, Betsy says to her teacher, I hate the ego, Charlie. And Charlie, the teacher, says, well, then ego has won. And Betsy says, what are you talking about? I told you I hate ego. And Charlie says, well, Betsy, ego doesn't care who you hate. It just wants to make sure you hate. And even if you're hating the ego gets strengthened. And the part of you that wants to destroy your ego is the ego. What these books, like the Richard Moss book and so many others, are pointing us to is that if we step back and observe the process, in acceptance, in allowance, in surrender, we drop the resistance, we drop the labeling, we drop the comparison, we drop the grandiosity and the depressive nature of our thought patterns, and we just watch our thought patterns with that kind of childlike curiosity. Oh, that's interesting. Look what I'm doing there. That's when the effects of the ego fall away, and then we have the liberty to choose differently. At the end of that chapter, he says, the process of awakening into greater awareness and presence is sometimes referred to as the death of the ego. In fact, many spiritual teachings talk about killing the ego, but indeed, when I do that, I'm not developing a higher degree of presence. I'm engaging in the battlefield, in the tug of war, in the resistance, in the hatred. So what I want to do is get more aware of the process. And the more aware I become of the process and the fullness of my awareness and its potential to step into and then outside of the ego, that's when it loses its power over me. So, 563-999-3581. Thoughts about ego, thoughts about awareness, thoughts about your role in either being present in the moment so that you can use the tool of ego as opposed to being ruled by it. Susan, welcome.
Hi, I just got a call from Mira Rubin. Are you willing to give a hint about how your interview went?
Say that again. I just turned the volume up. You got a call
okay.
from who?
Mira Rubin.
Yes.
Who
and?
Said she enjoyed being interviewed by you very much. And I don't know if it's appropriate if I ask how it went, and could you tell us when the air date is?
Well, it just got recorded today. When the air date is going to depend on a variety of factors, including how quickly she can get me her headshot and bio, which I've requested. Currently, I think if she gets it to me, it might be posted or published on October 12th.
Okay.
And, you know, depending upon how many people clamor for it, it might even be run as a Mindshifters radio show even before then. You never know. We have all kinds
okay.
of possibilities.
All right. Good.
Currently, I have other... Yesterday was posted the Dr. Joquita Handy, Every Child is Brilliant, Helping Children with Autism and Other Learning Disabilities. And then next week we have Morgan Beard, a music therapist, a young music therapist who's a lived experience with mental health challenges. And then on the 5th we have Dr. Patrick Porter, who created the Brain Tap device and helps people heal their brain with light and sound. And if all goes
wow.
well, the Mira Rubin episode would be on the 12th of October.
Wow, you've been cooking. That's a lot.
Well, it's one of those deals where when people want something every week, and if you just think, oh, I'll do one every week, then if you have something come up like the interview that was supposed to be done this Friday, I just got a notice yesterday that the gentleman's wife is ill and he's going to have to be tending her when she comes home from the hospital, so he can't do the interview. So if I was only, you know, if I wasn't getting a backlog, then every time somebody had a glitch, we wouldn't have a podcast. So I try to have, you know, 4, 5, or 6 of them recorded and ready to go in case something comes up.
Wow.
Which is quite the challenge
That's
sometimes
great.
because life happens. Yeah.
I
know. So how are you? We haven't heard from you in a couple days.
Well, things are calming down and blowing up at the same time. I mean, we've had an influx of refugees here, and we ran an enormous, it was like a yard sale, but we weren't charging anything for it. And we've spent about 6 weeks gathering donations from all over the place to my church basement, and we could do it out of the basement, which is the community, the refugee community center there. Because we've been closed down, we used it for this giveaway, and the intention was to let the refugees come in and take what they needed. We didn't charge anybody anything, not even the regular people who came. We asked for donations, and we made about $850, which was pretty modest, but I was surprised anyway. But we did have some refugees come and go off with armloads of bedding and pillows and pots and pans, and it was really, really heartening to see. And I've met one wonderful new refugee, a woman from Iraq, who is in her 40s and fluent in English, so she may get a job as a translator very soon. Wonderful woman. and with two teenage sons. She told me she had been through four wars, but the worst war for her was within her own marriage. It turned out that the husband wasn't well, and it was a very abusive situation. So she fled Iraq to Turkey, and she wanted to come here, but she could only get as far as Turkey. And she lived in Turkey for 8 years before she got here with her now teenage boys. And they are living in a house because we have a refugee service that places people, gets them settled, pays them enough to live on until they get a job, and there's a cutoff date of 3 months. So we've been working with her, and she's a, you're going to laugh, Dr. Tim, she's a belly dancer. And she's going to come and be a guest teacher on one of my in one of my Pilates classes. I think my students are going to be blown away. But anyway, there's that. And then Tim and I are taking in a Sudanese woman who's coming in about 10 days to live with us for 6 to 9 months until they find housing for her, because housing is terrible here. It's probably terrible everywhere. A one-bedroom apartment costs $1,200, and the refugee services doesn't have that kind of money, so they're asking families to take in people, and we're taking in this woman. So I've been doing worksheets about, you know, having a whole new life here, and I can't imagine what it must be like for them. Michael was talking with me about it yesterday, and he said, you just can't imagine the trauma they've been through. So, and we don't think this woman speaks English, so it's going to be interesting. But anyway, that's why I've been gone missing in action. But things have settled down, and we've deposited all the remaining stuff to Salvation Army and another organization, and we're getting back to normal for a minute anyway. But so that's, you got the long answer to how you've been doing. A lot
you've been
going
busy.
On.
Yeah, you've been busy.
Yeah. So the lesson today, creation's gentleness is all I see. And I would love to just talk about that, or not talk about it, but hear you interpret that in the light of the fact that, for instance, yesterday I saw an owl take a dive into grass near the highway, and I think she died there. That wasn't a gentle thing to see, but there's death all over the place and wars all over the place. So I know we have
to adjust
our
scene. Okay, so here's my take on it. You just gave us, as you talked about what's been going on for you, you just gave us a way to see the loving, creative, gentle side of life, even in the face of these people who have been refugees from wars and are, you know, they're running from the traumas in their world. But where they run to is into the arms and hands and hearts of people like you and those at your church. So there's always, you know, everything is this ebb and flow. There's always the give and take. There's always going to be what people call evil and bad because our minds work that way. But it's really just the flow of life. And the truth of it is there's always many, many, many times, perhaps millions, perhaps trillions of times more good going on the planet than there is bad. Always. And the choice is, what are we going to look at? And that's what the lesson for today calls us to. What eyes are we going to look at this with? It says, I have misunderstood the world because I laid my errant energy upon it, my interpretations, my fears, my sadness, my pain, my sins on it. And then I saw all that garbage that I put on it staring back at me. So what do I look at? Do I look at the fact that we aren't everyone in this moment acting according to our true nature? Or do I look at how many people are waking up to their true nature, how many people, even in moments of strife and struggle, look for the helpers, become the helpers, support those in need, etc. You know, I had this pattern I've been talking to people about for a long time. When you hear of something like the Sandy Hill shooting or the Twin Towers coming down or whatever, what do you want to focus on? The fact that one or two people did this violent thing driven by their own pain and fear and sadness? Or do you want to look at the hundreds of thousands and millions of people that rush in to help? Right. There's a gentleman who wrote the book Brain Spotting, and he talks about how he donated his time and he trained other therapists, and they helped people with trauma from the Twin Towers, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours that they're just donating their time to help these people. Do you look at that, or do you look at the one or two people that wanted to create this mess? Same thing with the Sandy Hill shooting. So one person gets a gun, goes out and does all of this violence. Do we focus on that, or do we focus on, look at how many people sent prayers, money, you know, emotional comfort, therapists donated their time and flocked there to help the people with trauma, with the immediate responders. And so what do you want to focus on? That, to me, today's lesson is calling us to that, because there's always the Creator's view, which is everything in its wholeness, everything always expanding. The sun's going to come up tomorrow. You know, we just hit the equal time in our northern hemisphere for daylight and darkness, but we still have plants growing. We still have people who are looking to harvest, you know, their melons and their tomatoes, and all of this is still going. What are you going to focus on? The breath of life that's moving through you and the heartbeat in you that is the miracle that it is, and the way that people are so blessed to have you and the others in that church welcome them when they are refugees. What do you focus on?
That's
today's
good
lesson. Focus. Go ahead. That's good because the lesson what?
I didn't really read it right. Creation's gentleness is all I see. It didn't say is all there is.
Yes, now you're getting it.
Okay.
The images that I see reflect my thoughts. And yet, my mind is connected to the Creator's mind, so I could choose to focus differently. And remember this thing that I have typed out that I hand to people in my sessions, because they say, wait a minute, that's confusing, that's difficult.
Right.
Okay, well, two things. You have the infinite capacity to choose the focus of your conscious awareness in each moment, and it's the focus of your conscious awareness in each moment that actually creates your experience of life. So are you going to create an experience of sadness and trauma and upset because you're interacting with these refugees? And if you do that, how are you going to help them? Are you going to open yourself to the miracle of life and the blessing of the opportunity to share with them and to help them? And here's this woman who speaks fluent English, who's a belly dancer, who's probably got all kinds of other skills that you're going to have. You know, your life is going to be changed because you had access to her, and her life's going to be changed for the better because she's had access to you. Are you going to focus on that? Or are you going to focus on, oh, this sad trauma about this and that, which, by the way, you don't have any ability to change. You do have the ability to change your experience in this moment and that person's experience in this moment, and that's where this lesson and all of the work I do with people would direct your attention.
This is so interesting, and I'm going to steer us. I have a question, and it may be going too far off track, but yesterday I was driving with my grandson who has his permit, so he's the one that's driving, and I'm just the responsible adult in the car with a license. And I had been feeling sort of ill in my stomach. My stomach seems to tell me, in other words, what my thoughts are, even though I'm not aware of my thoughts. And Ellen was telling us about it by Sat Prem, called The Mind of the Cells, and I've just ordered it. I found a used copy, thank goodness, because it's very expensive. But I'm curious about the fact that I can be feeling really not well, and I know it's my thoughts, but I don't know what my thoughts really are, or they may be like that owl took a dive and probably died in the grass, and I was feeling it. All of my fears have been stirred up. They've been stirred up about taking this Sudanese woman home. But it starts with a feeling in my gut, and then I have to say, what's going on here? Can I put a word to this sick feeling in my stomach? And then I can. And then the stomach stuff goes away. So I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, except it seems as if what I'm choosing to see is unconscious at the beginning of it, is not even conscious.
Okay. And so that's why I talk so much about the two-prong approach. The two-prong approach is I choose, as often as I can remind myself to do it, to focus on the good, to look for that positive filter, to remember my true nature, and then take an action from that. That's that definition of faith from the ancient Aramaic, right? To act from the rooted center of your being, to get consciously aware of your true nature as this force for love and creation, and then take an action. And the second prong of that approach is I acknowledge when my stomach is in a knot. I acknowledge when I get a twitch in my neck. I acknowledge when there's a stabbing pain in my low back. And I don't think, oh, I better get to the doctor. I think, oh, what is this trying to tell me? And I work with it. And I understand that the unconscious or the part of my consciousness that I'm not willing to look at easily holds useful information for me and is often the key to my physical comfort or discomfort. And so I use the tools to dismantle what might be there that's outside my conscious awareness, but it's making itself known, right, through the energy system that we call the mind and the body. It's making me aware that something's off the mark.
Yeah.
So I pick up a tool. If I'm in a situation
right.
like that with you, and I'm in a car with somebody, and I start to feel that sick feeling in my stomach, I start doing EFT tapping. I start asking to be shown. Some people might call it a prayer. And I work with what is up in the moment and bring my awareness to it, the way Richard Moss is talking about. I bring the presence moment awareness to it, and I use some of the tools that I've been given. Keep the energy moving.
It takes a while sometimes. Yeah. I couldn't get much traction for a while, but it did dissipate, and it dissipates a lot faster. I started tapping, actually, in the car. I just started tapping my legs, because my grandson wouldn't even really notice that. I didn't want to do anything totally weird, but breathing and tapping.
Well, you know, to truly heal, you're going to have to be willing to do some really totally weird stuff eventually. In a society as sick and crazy as ours, if all you want to do is the stuff that's not weird, you're going to limit your ability to heal and integrate.
I totally agree. Tim Bingham and I were just on our Zoom call, and we were talking to Ellen about the mind of the cells and life without death and mother's agenda and this Sat Prem guy. And Tim looks at me and he says, do you know what she's talking about? And I said, my mind is coming close to it. I'm excited about it. I've got this feeling about it. Yeah. And he said, you're becoming extremely weird. So we're going to have to deal with the weirdness factor in the house, definitely. But Dr. Tim, I have another question. I just read something that Guy Finley put out, and I have a hard time deciphering the way he words things, whether he's speaking or writing. So I wondered if it would be okay, this is related, if I could read you two short paragraphs that he wrote in a recent webinar, for a recent webinar. Okay, part one. What power has any painful moment over us, save for having become unconsciously identified with our own negative reaction to it?
Okay, so
this
stop
is just
right
what we've
there.
Been talking about.
So stop
yeah.
right there.
Yeah.
What power does any negative reaction have over us, except for our identification with it? Right. Read it again, please.
What power has any painful moment over? What power has any painful moment over us, save for having become unconsciously identified with our own negative reaction to it?
Okay, so here's the point. The outside event has no power over us. The only power that we experience is when we identify with our negative reaction to it. So this is why the keys to the kingdom in the core, in the ways of master, are allowance, surrender, humility, right? Acceptance and allowance and surrender to whatever happens in life. And when I'm not allowing and surrendering to what happens in life, I'm feeling the tension that comes from the resistance, and then I identify with that tension. I say, I'm angry. I am anger. I am so angry. I am so scared. And I identify with that rather than doing that step back, take a breath, allow, accept. This is energy moving through my system. This moment does not define me or my life. But if I identify with it, and if I think I need to fight against it, the first thing is I create the upset that I experience. The next thing is I think I'm right because I say this thing is wrong, and I set myself up as being, you know, opposite of what's wrong, so therefore I'm right. But if I take a breath and I say, wow, this isn't how I expected my day to go. I wonder how this is going to turn out better than I could have imagined. I wonder how this is going to lead to a lesson I need to learn to move forward. I wonder how this is going to hold blessings for me that I can't even see from my current position. If I do that, I have an entirely different experience of the moment. And the moment, therefore, and this thing that I label negative, has no power over me if I don't label it negative. And it has even, you know, less impact on me when my resistance to it, when I notice that resistance, I catch it, take that breath we talk about where I hold the energy at the top and then slowly exhale down, and I turn the focus inside myself. Now I'm not focusing on the outside event and what I don't want to have happen and how I know I'm right and the world is wrong. Now I'm focusing on what's the part of me that's creating the upset, and I'm softening and breathing and asking to be shown how I'm creating the negative emotion or what's the interpretation I've placed on this event that's generating this pain or fear or sadness. And then it moves through me infinitely faster than when I tighten and resist it.
I can feel that. Yeah. Guy Finley goes on to say, seen properly, this means the event we blame for our suffering is like looking in a mirror and blaming the reflection for whatever we don't want to see in it.
Exactly.
That's pretty much what you were saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I only have a negative experience when I resist the flow of life. Go ahead. What is he saying then?
It's just one more sentence, and then I won't read the rest. Part two, he says, our willingness and the inner work it takes, what you were just talking about, to be aware of the hopelessness in any negative reaction is the first step in transforming its innate futility into a new, true, and higher destiny. I love that. If you have anything negative, it's hopeless. It's just not any, it's a dead end.
It came to me a few years ago to say, my definition for being stuck is when I'm experiencing a negative thought or a negative emotion. My definition for being hopelessly stuck is when I argue for my negative thought or emotion.
Oh, that's great. You know what? You should do a couple of little earbud podcasts that are like 30 seconds long and have us buy them and we'll stick them in our ear when we're suddenly triggered. We just we listen to a nano podcast by Tim Hayes. Instant straightening out. No, that was good. So anyway, yeah. Good. Well, that's about what I was going to ask you about. And
so one of the things that comes up with Guy Finley's writing is it's very similar to some of the stuff in The Course in Miracles where it starts talking about, you know, the negatives and the double negatives.
Right.
And,
I know.
And so it requires, you know, slowing down, and for me, it requires my slowing down and parsing out, okay, what's it really saying here? And you can hear it sometimes if you're reading along in the lesson with me that I make those course corrections sometimes on the fly. And I the wording. I change the wording so that it doesn't say, I can't but see this or that or this or that. And when I'm doing that or that, how can I not help but do this or that? And it's all the negatives. And so I work to straighten it out, and I have to do the same thing with a lot of Guy Finley's presentations because he's such a fluent writer and speaker, and he has these, you know, 2 and 3 paragraph long sentences.
It's amazing.
But you'll find the very same message from Course in Miracles, Way of Mastery, Michael Rice's talks. You'll find the very same thing in Guy Finley's talks. Because they're excellent observers, and they're all observing the same thing. They're observing our life. They're observing our process of thought.
So, Dr. Tim, he did write some more. Do you want me to read more, or do you want to take another caller, or what?
Well, nobody else has their hand up, so what's your next question?
Well, it isn't a question. I was just going to keep reading on this, what he does, which is very good. His podcast, his webinars are so late at night that I don't listen to them live. And then I often don't even listen to the playback because he writes a summary. And I find his summaries are really useful, and I can do them.
His special writings, His special writings for the talk.
Yeah, right. I wonder if those are, do you happen to know whether he writes those ahead of the webinar or he does a summary of afterward?
Well, I don't know if he ever does them afterwards, but he usually comes into each talk with a special writing. And sometimes he wrote that special writing a week or two before the talk, and he gets another one that comes right before the talk, sometimes minutes before. So there'll be another one tucked in the middle of the presentation.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Amazing. Well,
and
he says, you know, when a wave...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to start reading again, so talk. Yeah, see.
Well, let's have you read. I was just going to mention that he has that book about, you know, relationship magic, and he's been doing some talks on that and promoting those. And what you just read sounds like part of that book, Relationship Magic.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't gotten that book. Okay, so I'll read a little bit and see what happens. When a wave of negative reactions comes along, something in us that believes itself to be apart from the wave steps in and tries to mitigate or resolve it, and this never works. As long as we run into the wave, try to fight with it, change its direction, or evaporate the ocean, there's only one possibility. What's the possibility? The continuity of conflict. That's the only possibility there is. The reaction actually drives the situation deeper and strengthens the idea that, quote, I really don't want to be an unhappy person. I really don't want to worry, but I just have to. That's so cool, end quote.
He had a window into your mind, didn't he, when he wrote
that?
Yeah,
he did. Yeah. I don't think we need to go any further. It's getting embarrassing.
But it's all of us, right? It's all of us.
Yeah.
It's the same process for everyone. We create our negativity. Life is just this flow of energy. If you listen to that Michael Singer presentation, if you read his two books, life is a flow of energy. In that one 8-hour class he did, he said he spent a whole hour talking about the best our scientists can determine that what we call the physical universe began 13.84 billion years ago. And it's been unfolding in a creative process ever since. And everything you see, every person you see, every object you touch, the ground you're walking on is composed of atoms that were born in these explosions 13.4 billion years ago.
Whoa.
And it's been a part of this flow of creation, just like what is inevitably going to happen when I, you know, plant the seed in the ground and it gets the proper soil nutrients, water, and sunlight. It's going to become the plant that is contained within the seed. The blueprint for it is contained. So what's going to unfold in my life in this next day, week, hour, month, year is the part of that extension of creation. And I've got this mind that sometimes forgets to zip up my pants zipper, and it wants to judge what's unfolding and say, that's bad, that's wrong, that shouldn't happen.
God, may we remember this.
And in that moment, I create the negativity that I experience in the moment. There is no negativity in the moment. I create the negativity. I look down, I see my pants are unzipped, and I go, oh, you idiot. Oh, my God, I wonder who saw that. Oh, and I create a bunch of negativity around a zipper open or closed. And there's no negativity in the experience until I bring it. There's no anger floating around out there in the world, unique, independent from the mind that creates it. From what is it created from? Resistance.
Mm. I love the sentence he said. I really don't want to be an unhappy person. I really don't want to worry, but I just have to. That is absolutely what I've been doing my whole life.
Yeah.
That
and,
is like,
you know,
being right.
Exactly. That is being right. That's not like being right. That's a special form of I'm right.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Kim, can I ask you a question about my session with Mira?
Sure.
Did you end up having one with her?
Yes, Saturday.
Okay, so you experienced how she works. Why? Because I've found it absolutely mind-blowing, because my mind wasn't there, really. And when Tim Bingham asked me, how did it go? I said, I don't know. I don't know what to say about this. But it was good. And then we signed up. Both Tim Bingham and I both signed up to do the 3-month deal with her. And I was very resistant at first because of the cost, which when broken down is perfectly reasonable. And the second reason was I consider you and Michael I'm working with you. You're my people. So I felt disloyal. I thought, I'm going to have sessions with somebody else. I haven't been in you know, is this okay? And I went through all that and then decided.
Susan, does that mean we have to break up?
Yeah. I really thought I'd have to confess. I thought I'd have to confess that I'm working with this person. And I feared that you or Michael might think that, what, we're chopped liver now? I mean, what's the deal? I went through all this. It's crazy.
That's good.
So, yeah, that's good. So,
what about the session that you want to ask?
I don't even know how to ask it. It was just what she did, which was to stay absolutely glued to what I was saying, and I was glued to allowing my mind to go wherever it was going to go, no matter how insane, which is exactly the pattern that you recommend doing in the worksheet. But she stayed in there in a way that I don't. I'm going to now, I hope, but she stayed there and pushed gently. It was like sinking into slime, that slime stuff that kids play with, just kept reshaping and pushing and reshaping and pushing, and my mind was showing me things that I haven't thought of ever and bringing in things that I wouldn't, they weren't foreign, but they were new. And at the end of it, I can't tell you, we didn't come to an enlightened goal. I guess that's it. We didn't come to an enlightened goal. We just stopped, came to a stopping place and stopped, and I felt different. But I couldn't tell you any kind of enlightened goal, but I'm a different person. I've had two sessions with her, and I feel so much more empowered, so much healthier. Knock on wood, I'm afraid this is going to come and bite me in the behind because I'm, you know, tempting the fates and saying this. I felt changed by it. And I felt as if what she was doing is fleshing out the patter. She was doing patter to the extent that you probably have always recommended doing, but I've never done it that much.
Well,
so,
part of the dynamic there that I experience so often is this word, you want to call it willingness, you want to call it openness, you want to call it softening, whatever you want to call it. And I say it that way because, you know, yesterday in the support group, somebody was saying, every time I say the word willingness, they have a negative reaction. And they feel as though I'm saying that with willingness, all this growth happens, and then they're not growing enough, and they think I'm judging them as not being willing. And then they get upset.
Oh.
But the idea is you, with her as a guide, you have a different level of willingness to stay in the pattern, to stay in the observation, to stay in the moment, than you do when you're alone.
Mm.
Sometimes there's a distraction factor, and you have the outside coach to help you stay focused. And sometimes it's, you know, a willingness that's, you know, threatened by or diminished by the fears that come up at that part of our mind that we're not yet seeing consciously. And that's where the benefit of a coach is. You know, we've had people come into the support group and say, I don't get it. I get so much more out of these worksheets when I do them in the group than I do at home. And one guy even said, I find that I'm even more honest with myself when I do them out loud in the group than when I do them at home. And he said, and I thought it would be the opposite. I thought I would be able to be more honest at home alone. But he said, I find the absolute opposite. And that's a direct result in my eye and ear of this kind of thing. He's bumping up against some serious, very big in his mind, horrible things that he's probably been holding on to since he was 5 years old, and he doesn't realize that they're fake, that they're all false, and it's just an illusion. So he uses the strength and the loving support of the people in the group to stay with it better when he's doing a worksheet out loud in the group. And that's what's happening when you're with someone like Mira.
Yeah.
At least that's one way to think about it. So we've reached the end of the time. So thank you again for comments, questions, the Guy Finley stuff, all of that. I will mute you and let you hang on for the second hour, and if you so desire, I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I appreciate it. Good show.
All right. Have a great show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Wednesday, September the 22nd, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. While we're waiting on Michael to get dialed in, Susan, I'm going to turn your mic back on. Who is this lady that you're talking about, Mira, who?
Rubin, R-U-B-I-N.
Okay. Thank you. I was just going to put her
information
in the notes.
I'm sure you. Good, yeah.
Yeah. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. I think I heard Susan's voice there. How are you, young lady?
I am better than I should be, Michael. It's all
No,
your
you're
fault.
Probably just perfect right the way you are.
How are you?
You know, the truth is, as we do our work, we get to the point where we can be in the deepest muddle, mire, mess, muck that anybody could be in, and love and serenity stay present. Now, that's
well,
the end result of the work. That's what. Well,
yeah.
That's what's supposed to happen. That's the idea of doing it. Because and recognize that most of the world thinks that their muck and their mire and their muddle and their pain and their trauma and their drama and their anxiety and their fear and their rage and their guilt are all coming from the outside. And none of it's true. When you start working to remove it from the inside and it's gone, then it's gone. There's no reason to have it in the world.
Well,
so congratulations.
Said, well, I say it's your fault. You said a couple of things about Jacob that I can't even remember. But Jacob called last night, and he swung into a rant and rage about political correctness and how tiresome it is, and he was going on and on about how he doesn't like school. And I was rejoicing because that's my boy. That's what he'd been doing before he started on the drugs. He was complaining about everything, and he even said that he's been taking those drugs in order to fit in with his classmates who are all doing it. He wanted to be part of the gang. He's decided this is just baloney. He's not going to do it anymore. I hope this sticks. But, like, my Jacob came back. He was back already.
Sweet.
And we had a great talk. And we talked about the definition of humility that I think you said on the show, or Dr. Tim, to see the highest and best in everyone and to operate from that stance.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to do that. I've been doing it. I think I've been doing it, but now I'm aware of doing it, and I'm going to do it. And I said, you start the ball rolling. He said, everybody's so mean. People bully people. They're critical. Everybody's scared. And he said, I can be the one to start the ball rolling toward kindness, being kind. And he just sounded so much better.
That, sweet.
Man. And then the other thing you said about the Sudanese woman, you said, use touch, use the absence. Think about the trauma she's been through. I was thinking about my trauma of having my introverted life interrupted. All of a sudden, the focus has shifted, and I'm ready to bring her in. So you did two great things yesterday, Michael, and you probably didn't even realize it.
No, you did it. You're the one whose mind changed.
No, you did it.
Mind changed.
Well, anyway, it helped
you
a
know,
lot.
There's a wonderful story about Michelangelo and some admirer is standing there looking at the statue of David. And he's just like, how is that even possible? And Michelangelo said, David was always in the piece of granite. I just took my hammer and chisel and removed what wasn't him. That's what forgiveness is. It's the hammer and chisel with which you remove what isn't you. And what isn't you is
like
fear and rage and guilt and grief. What is you is a state of being called love. And that's the truth for all of us, no matter how bizarre and off the wall and insane we seem to be. And so the hammer and chisel is looking at the thought disorders, chiseling, forgiving, removing those thought disorders, and returning simply to the truth of who we are. You know, that the passage in the Course, you've heard me read it several times, it says, and it is around the whole idea of words, and it says, it'd be interesting if you were asked to take a teaching function and yet forego the words of darkness, and that you need intervals, and you had an interval yesterday, in which you go into the light and then return to the darkness and use the words that the world of darkness rules, not because you believe them, but as a way to proclaim their fallibility, as a way to proclaim their fraud and get free of them. And that's basically what all we did yesterday, all you did yesterday, your willingness to step into it. And, of course, the fruit of the work you've been doing for several years now with this work and all the other work you've done for decades. So congratulations.
Thanks.
Tis pretty awesome. Tis pretty awesome. And, you know, the whole idea of the first century Aramaic forgiveness process is it takes away, it does nothing but remove the illusion, the thought disorders. And it's a quantum leap different and way beyond anything that's ever been presented in the English language about forgiveness to date, as far as I know, and anything I've been able to find. And, you know, many people think of forgiveness in the domain of theology. It doesn't belong in the domain of theology. It's pure physics. It's physiology. It's psychology. It's a tool with which deep, pure, and profound genetic repair is carried out. So it's the hammer and chisel, the tool set with which we remove the unconscious impulses of fear and hate and greed and the self-medicating drug of rage that the world uses so much. So, you know, each of us has a work we need to sink into, and I just, you know, I'm appreciative of you and delighted to watch how willing you are to just sink in each time another layer comes up, sink into the next level of your own work, perhaps starting the conversation out with, oh, look what's happening out there, but your willingness to just go back in and face those culturally imposed generations of self-deception and getting rid of the, you know, forgiveness basically frees us from those internal shards of fear and pain, hostility, greed that obscure the truth of who we are. And when we're loosed from the hostility and greed that obscure that true human life, that ever-repeating past that most everybody lives in, why is this happening to me again? The courage to do the work of forgiveness, it removes the veneer of civility, what passes, you know, the politically correct, and allows us to face what's in the domains of the unconscious. And as you do that, you enter into conscious co-creation rather than unconscious. And, you know, there's a reward for that. To he that overcomes. To she that overcomes.
Michael, I've got a question. We talk about carbon-based memory and what's in the cells too, and the cells, the DNA has a memory, and ancestral trauma is passed down, good things too, I trust. Is it possible to work starting with the cell, to heal the cell without knowing anything about the trauma, but just assuming trauma's there? And heal from
absolutely
the bottom up.
Absolutely. Someone who's an alcoholic, a drug addict, a food junkie, and changes their dietary regimen, they're going to be, you know, with no thought of ever, oh, I'm going to deal with my life. But all of those things being the things that drive down our vitality and our strength and our capacity to operate that hammer and chisel of Michelangelo, the forgiveness chisel, those things, just by doing those things, you vitalize yourself and automatically the energy starts to flow. I was talking to someone yesterday who has been using the Avicen for about, I think, a year now, close to a year. And she was saying that what she's noticing when she's got her hand in the Avicen now is that all of these memories, all of these things that she's recalling that she had no memory of. You know, this is a woman who's in her 70s, actually almost in her 80s. It's a woman I told you who had polio as a child, post-polio syndrome in her shoulder. She had so much pain in her shoulder she couldn't pick up a glass of water. And after 12 weeks on the Avicen, she was able to pack up her house, load the boxes in her car, and move them. And what she's noticing, you know, the long term, is that as she's laying there with the Avicen with her hand in it, that she's processing all these memories just coming forward. And so, yeah, anything you do on any level, you know, when they said be holy, it didn't mean get down on your hands and fold, or get down on your knees and fold your hands. That isn't holy. It's whole. It's working on every level. And on any and every level that you improve, you're going to move the life, the whole life form forward, whatever it is. Because if we're at the full physical vitality, that is the nutrition fully, you can't hold on to the garbage. It just can't stay in the field. And, you know, all we have to do is look around at the popularity of the drugs that are pushed in, you know, virtually every corner in every restaurant. Let's just take that one caffeine. And everybody who uses it on a daily basis shuts down the flow of information within their minds and just give up coffee. And all of a sudden, things will start to move and process. And the more things you're inclined to do to vitalize yourself, the more and deeper your process is going to be. So this one's talking about how she's just having these early, early, early memories come up. She's recalling things that she totally shut out of her mind and out of her life. So it's each aspect that we improve, physical, mental, emotional, relational, financial, is going to tend to strengthen every other aspect and uplift. That would be my take.
Well, that makes total sense. Our teacher in Vedanta years ago, a Swami who lived in New York, used to say, picture yourself as a fortress. I've probably said this on the show before. You have this fortress and it's surrounded with soldiers standing facing outward shoulder to shoulder. All you have to do is make friends with one of those soldiers and you're in. Just start somewhere. And that's what basically I think what you're saying.
That's it.
I wish I understood. I went to see a naturopath the other day because of my sleep difficulties, and we ended up having a discussion, and I brought her all the supplements that I take in a bag, and she looked at this and she said, well, you don't need this, but you do need that. And she does muscle testing, and I'm not sensitive
right
that way. I don't think I can discern what's good and what's not. I wouldn't trust myself, but she does. And it just seems to me some people are really, oops, there's my doorbell, really, really gifted. Hang on, Michael.
Sure.
All right, I'm here.
Okay.
I lost.
So you're saying some people are gifted in doing things like muscle testing.
Yeah. Right. So we have to go to them to find out who we are and stuff. Right. Have you ever done that?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've done some training in muscle testing, and it wasn't my cup of tea. I know some people who are very good at it and seem to get very good results. And I know some people who do it and they're always telegraphing the results they expect, so they get the results that they expect. And that I don't think is valid. But there are some people I think use
it quite
validly.
Well, that's what I would be doing. Yeah, that's what I would be doing, is I would, my brain would be too involved. So anyway.
What was that? Who was it that told us to get our bloated nothingness out of the way?
My bloated nothingness is right in there. Okay.
Well, it sounds like you're doing pretty good, young lady, and inspiring that young man and you know, opening a space with him. And it sounds like he's opening a space for you as well. And that's the, you know, the mutual support of community and people doing the work together. So it's, that's sweet to hear that report with him.
Thanks.
And it sounds
like
it might be an opening for him to have, you know, more and more of the tools, you know, give him the that sympathetic, parasympathetic exercise. Simple stuff like that can make the world of difference.
Is that the one you said would put your head over, hand over your ear and tip your head and look up? Is that the one?
Yeah. You take your, you know, start out in either your right or your left hand, use your right hand, put it over top of your head, just rest your fingers on your head, just above your ear, and you pull your head down gently, just comfortably, pull the head down to the right as far as it will comfortably go, and as you do that, look up with your eyes way up and to the left as though you're trying to look up and out through the top of your head, and breathe and let your whole body blow up like a bubble, so you're stretching everything. Big breath. And a couple of breaths like that. If the neck loosens, you can pull the head down a little further. Again, keeping the eyes looking up as though they're trying to look up through the top of the head. And then do the same on the other side. Go to the center, relax a little bit. Put the fingers of the left hand just over the top of the head, so they're just above the ear, resting on the head. And you know, so you've got a lever there. You pull your head over towards your left shoulder, as far as it will comfortably go. Breathe, body blows up like a bubble, so everything stretches, and you look up to the right, as though you're trying to look up through the top of your head with your eyes, both eyes pointed up that way. Big breath, let everything stretch and open. That tends to move people from the sympathetic dominant state, which is survival, into the parasympathetic dominant state, which is thrival.
Thrival, I love it. Does that have
thrival
to do
instead
with
of survival. Say again?
Vagus nerve.
Open the vagus nerve, yes.
Okay. I don't know what the vagus nerve is, but I told my Pilates students how to do it.
Yeah. Well, the vagus nerve, it's called vagus. The word vagus means wandering. And if you look at up on the internet, you'll see that it wanders. I mean, it's one of the longest nerves in the body, and it wanders throughout the whole torso, especially. It comes out of the brain and through the whole torso and enervates all of the important thriving functions of the body, digestion, cell repair, respiration, the function of the visceral organs, basically. And when we're cut off from that, because we're in survival mode, we don't need to digest when there's a lion coming at us. We want all the energy to go with what gets me out of the lion's path. And that's that sympathetic dominant state. You know, it's kind of a continuum. You're not in one or the other. They're a continuum.
Yeah.
But if people lean over toward the sympathetic dominant, then the flow, the nerve impulse to all of those organs, including parts of the brain and the colon, they just don't get innervation, and they don't function very well. So this physiologically stretches them, that nerve, and opens the pathway and tends to shift out of the sympathetic dominant state into the parasympathetic dominant state, where all of a sudden those things that cause your body to thrive are fed abundantly. Nerve flow, blood flow, energy, and everything changes. Everything shifts. It opens a space for processing the drama and trauma, because there's, in this continuum from sympathetic to parasympathetic, there's also a third state of the nervous system, and that's freeze. And that's when people just, I mean, they literally physiologically can't take a step. And behaviorally, they can't do anything. They're just, you know, people will look at someone in that state, what's wrong with you? Why don't you just do something? There's no nerve flow. They can't do anything in that freeze state. And so what that exercise does is just a simple exercise for moving the structure toward that parasympathetic and opening, you know, stretching and allowing the nerve flow to move through the vagus nerve so that everything that vagus nerve innervates is innervated. And we tend to move into thrive mode or thrival instead of survival or freeze. And that's another one of those things. You know, if you look at, you know, we can improve nutrition, we stop using drugs, and we start eating food that has, you know, actual nutrition in it, as enzymes and minerals, and has what we need. You know, a body that's minerally or nutritionally deficient can't function properly. So this is just one more of those factors. You know, I don't know if you remember the intensive I talked about. I don't know for any given individual what factor is going to move them to the next level of vitality so that they can open and process whatever it is that they need to process. And so what I've worked to do, you know, I realized this many, like, I don't even know, 40, 45 years ago. There are factors involved. It isn't, if you do this, then healing will occur. There are factors. And, you know, if you need to move your vitality 2 points, well, you can move your vitality 2 points from going from a total junk diet to a total live food diet. And that will really move some energy and change things. But the tendency will be for the pendulum to swing back if you make that great a shift in one area. But if you move your nutrition, you know, a half a point, and you move your smiling, I mean, it's just the ability to smile changes physiology. You do something like this. Oh, there's another half a point. Oh, you turn down the drug. Well, you know, I might have a drink with you tomorrow night, but tonight I'm going to pass on the alcohol. That could be another. And the next morning, this person wakes up and they've done 6 little things that are not so major that they're going to tend to swing back and smash against the wall in the other direction. You know, if they got that 6-point shift from one thing, that the inertia would tend to just snap them back. But if they got it from 12 different things, then they tend better to be able to maintain it. And they might say, I don't know what happened. You know, I didn't take that drink last night. Yeah, I did have that sprout salad. Yeah, I did that exercise where you put your hand over, you know, just above your ear. And you know, I woke up in the morning and all of a sudden there I was thinking about that horrible trauma that happened when I was 3, and I remember to breathe, and you know, I breathed for about 20 minutes and I got up and wow, I felt so much better. Okay, tell me what you did to do that. Oh, I didn't have a drink last night. No. So people go, oh, it was the drink. So they'll stop drinking, but it won't make that change. So that's why in the intensive throughout this whole, you know, the whole idea here, why this conversation's gone on for 10 years is we're going to introduce every factor that we find. And we find new ones all the time, and I've been, you know, ferreting them out for the last 45 or so years since I realized it's factors that make the difference. And people who are inertia-bound will tend not to do one big major thing. Once in a while somebody will do it, but then they'll tend to step back. But they'll do a number of small things, and that can make the difference.
That brings up a question. I remember Ramakrishna saying years ago, I mean, when he was on the planet in the 1800s, he said, it's okay to have a treat once in a while. Mm-hmm. Now, you're talking about doing incremental improvements, which makes a lot of sense. But what you're basically saying is between the incrementals, some of the old habits are still in there, or some of the old things that you do. The other day I had a dish of ice cream, and I really liked it. But I thought, I wonder how much ice cream I could get away with. It isn't that I'm going to stuff myself, but I thought, I can't do this black and white. If I go out to an ice cream place, and Pennsylvania's full of these homemade ice cream. So went with my grandson and my son and his wife and Tim, and we walked there, and I thought, no way, I'm not going to have ice cream. I am going to have ice cream, and I'm going to love it. But then I had this question that's been sitting around on the edge of the mind is, you know, is that all right? Silly little question.
Yeah, my offering would be absolutely yes. Again, doing one's work doesn't require perfection in any area. It especially doesn't require perfection in every area. And so you quote-unquote fall off the wagon once in a while. So what? Jeannie made an awesome blueberry organic apple cobbler last night, and we had some oat milk ice cream on it. It was awesome.
Oh, good. I guess that was my question, and I should have just asked you outright, is do you ever do something like that?
Yes. I do it less and less. And we do something like that retreat once in a while, and we found that there's a particular store that has a pretty good apple pie that has a little bit of sugar in it, but not a whole lot. And so, you know, we'll do an apple pie every other week or so and, you know, do a piece a night for two or three nights. And yeah, of course, we do that. We don't have to live like hermits and the perfect symbol of, you know, doing everything right. All we have to do is make small incremental improvements that move us forward.
Yeah.
I can remember a time when I used to go in and I'd go into the grocery store and, you know, they'd have these chocolate-covered ice cream bars, and I would, and they, you know, they were small ones. So I could rationalize, you know, if there are only five of them in a package, so I'll go and eat them on the drive home. I don't do that anymore, but there was a time when I did. So, you know, we tend to improve and get better and better all the way around.
Right. I could say I do the same. Yes, that's good.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, they spoke to Yeshua, and he says, why do you call me perfect? What the heck are you talking about? None of us is. Now, I know there's a faction of Christianity that wants to pretend he was the perfect one, but those people have no real interest in hearing what he said. They're interested in what their preacher interpreted and said. And if you show them the words that you hear, look, here are his words. And there's docs often with the preacher. Well, yeah, but that's not what the preacher really meant. There's always an excuse. There's always a story about it. And so, but I suspect, you know, if he'd had a grocery store around the corner every once in a while, he'd have snuck in there and got himself a brick of ice cream.
Yum. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Michael.
We have a friend who, and you may have heard me talk about this before, but we have a friend who's not actually a naturopath, but she might as well be. It's someone that I first connected with doing this work up in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Oh, geez. 44, 45 years ago. Maybe not quite that long ago. Anyway, she's a real food purist. She's written a couple of books on food, and she did this work way back when I first met her. And we kept in touch over the years. And then back, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you've actually heard her on the show, 5 or 6 years ago, she came back to the work and really, really started to dig in and really use the tools. And she called me one day, and she was in healing crisis, and it was ice cream. And she's like, you know, I just don't eat that junk in the circles. We'd actually done a trainings together. She'd done a couple of my workshops, and we'd been in a couple of other trainings together. And in that circle, you know, the stuff that comes from a cow that they put in a package and call ice cream, the verbal link that's used for that one is it's called cow pus. And to help people to recognize that each state has a limit on how much pus they allow in milk and in cheese and in butter and in cream and in, you know, different dairy products. Each state has different limits of how much is allowed. And so, I mean, she was pretty much a purist. She's actually done the food program for an intensive on occasion. And she wouldn't touch that stuff, you know, in a million years. And she called me one day. She'd been doing some really deep work, and she's like, I don't know what's happened. I don't know what's going on. I've been in the grocery store, and I've been eating ice cream, and I just can't help myself. I'm just chowing down on this ice cream. It's like, well, what are you working on? Her father was a Middle Eastern, you know, typical Middle Eastern abusive male, you know, dismissive male toward females, including his daughter. And as a child, he was physically, mentally, and emotionally abusive. And so she had opened a layer of working through that. It was pretty intense. So she said, you know, I've been working on Dad and, you know, those, some of those issues. So, well, you know, when you were a kid and after Dad did his abuse thing, what would he do? I was like, bingo. Oh, my God. In order to make up for his abuse and apologizing, he'd take me for ice cream. So here she is, the habit of every time Dad abuses her, his way of making it up is to take her out for ice cream. And here she is in that healing crisis. And remember, one of the, you know, we talk about the symptoms of healing and the way you can tell that you're in a healing crisis rather than a disease process. And remember, the fourth one is, are you craving the drug you used when you experience that trauma initially in order to suppress that trauma? And that's part of it, because, you know, when you realize these are all energetic complexes, then, you know, if the drug was the sugar and the congestion and the morphine, there's actually in cow's milk, there's morphine, caseal morphine. It's as real as the morphine people put in their arms as a drug. So if that was the drug that was used, then that energetic pattern is locked into the tissue structure with the trauma that happened at that point. And so when I'm ready to open up and take that energetic pattern out of the cell, out of the tissue, as it starts to move out, all of the energies that are linked to it are going to tend to start to move. And so people will tend to crave, remember the symptoms of healing. How do you tell when you're in a healing process as opposed to a disease process when you're symptomatic? Well, on a physical level, healing looks like any kind of physical symptom you've ever had in low energy. On a mental level, it's any kind of negative thought you've ever had in confusion. On an emotional level, it's any kind of negative feeling you've ever had in depression. And when that energy starts to move, you ask yourself, so now, how do I tell? I've got all these symptoms. Am I in a healing process or a disease process? First question, am I doing more and more of the right things? Yes. Well, yeah, I had ice cream last night, but I used to do it 7 nights a week and 3 mornings a week. So yeah, I'm doing more and more of the right things. Had I hit a new level of vitality? Boy, I sure have. I woke up with, man, so much energy moving. Okay, so that's the second thing that says you're in a healing process. What's happening with your elimination? Oh, yeah. And we're talking about all of the eliminative channels. There tend to be an increase. You know, and it might be more one eliminative channel than another. One that really disturbs people is, let's say, when pimples or boils or, you know, rashes start to come up. That's part of the healing process if I'm doing more and more of the right things. So there are three questions that you ask yourself. And then the fourth one is, am I craving the drug that I used when this issue initially happened? And when I say, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing, then now I know I'm in a healing process. I know that the energy is moving out of the system. It's not Dr. Feelgood. And so now I call forward more willingness. I'm willing to do my work, and I'm going to do my best to keep on doing more and more of the right things, keep building my vitality, strengthening, and moving through those layers. And so for this young lady, it was just totally unconscious for her. And as soon as I said it, you know, what did Dad, it was just like, oh, my God, that's what's in. He used to take me out for ice cream. And here she is. I mean, this woman at that point was probably, I don't know, 60-ish. And she's eating ice cream like a little kid.
I wonder if she gave up the ice cream.
It dropped immediately. Once she was aware of it, she went back to the state where as a naturopath, or not actually a naturopath, but she might as well have been, as a person who's in that field, she was right back to her natural, like, I wouldn't touch that stuff with the 10-foot pole.
Wow.
That was like, that was instant for her. Once she got like, oh, that's what it is. The craving and the desire for it left.
Great.
And engage yourself or indulge yourself once in a while.
Or don't worry,
stuff
Michael.
You need to. You do, okay.
Right. Ice cream is a, but I never eat it without thinking, cow pus. Thanks a lot for that, Michael.
You're welcome. You know, when I was a kid, I was brought up, and my mother would have felt herself deficient if she hadn't fed us meat three times a day. Meat is a stimulant. A lot of people use meat, and it's not because it's good for them or it gives them something valuable. It's just a stimulant to the structure. So just like people use coffee as a stimulant, meat can do the same thing. And I can remember when I first, you know, started studying naturopathy and started to understand how the body worked, and that the human form is not designed. It can. It will never thrive on it, but the human form is not designed to eat dead animals. It's just decaying flesh is not what the structure is designed to be supported through. And I knew that intellectually, but, you know, I had eaten meat all my life, and it probably took me, I don't know, 13, 14 years to transition to where I would look at a piece of meat and go, you want me to eat that? No, thank you. I'll pass. Like, no
that
second thought.
Fish
say again?
And chicken poo? Fish and chicken
yeah,
poo?
Yeah, I'm talking the whole realm of, yeah. I mean, especially where it would be a problem for me. You know, I never ate meat. I always, you know, was vegetarian, and, you know, I'd chosen to be vegetarian, and that was it. But it was kind of interesting. I couldn't go into a restaurant and buy a meal that didn't have meat in it.
Wow.
That was kind of – and then, you know, it took – in order for my physiology – and remember, my heritage is Scottish. So, you know, Scottish Highlands, you know, meat-eating cows, that was, you know, how many generations of that? But to get to the point where I was able to process through that fully, where the attraction, the resonance, the inclination toward eating a piece of dead flesh totally left me, took me about 13 or 14 years.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, if you put it suggested, well, we're going to go to a restaurant and have a break. I'd almost throw up. Thank you very much. No, thank you. I'll pass. Like, there's no inclination whatsoever. But for that first 13 or 14 years after having chosen to be vegetarian, that energetic pattern, that's how long it took me to work through that one.
Wow.
And so if we're inclined to, you know. Uh-huh.
I was a vegetarian for quite a while, and I rarely eat meat, never eat red meat, but I do eat fish occasionally and chicken less often, but I maybe it's all in my mind. I think I need it. I've got this idea.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's all it is.
Well, if it's in your mind, until your mind changes, you'll probably need it.
Right. Also, you have to be really creative if you're a vegetarian, and I don't like cooking. I make big, big salads, and I put seeds in them and all kinds of things, but I always just, it doesn't feel heavy enough or something.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Michael, I'm not really arguing with you. It's just that I'm not as far along as you are by a long shot.
No. You probably need to be listening to your body, and when your body says you need meat, you should probably eat meat. And if you realize, like the alcoholic who says, you know, I'm craving a drink, I need a drink, well, you know, if there's a point, if you're really listening and tracking yourself, you'll know whether it's a drugs-type craving or that there's something that you're not yet digesting. You know, one of the worst things that somebody who's a heavy meat eater can do is, and people do this, is instantly overnight become vegetarian. They get themselves in deep trouble because there's so much protein in meat. I mean, we've been scammed by the meat industry. You know, that's where the big bucks are, is in chickens and dairies and dead cows and dead pigs and dead, you know, flesh. And the protein that's there, we've been sold this bill of goods about all how we need all that protein. And the structure adapts when one eats that kind of toxic food all the time, adapts, and it learns to throw out the first protein that comes in. I mean, it throws protein out by the ton. If you stop eating
so
that overnight and eat a vegetarian, a balanced vegetarian diet that has the proper amount of protein, it's still going to throw out that first protein that comes in, and people can become protein deficient. Now, there's never been anybody, you will never find a hospital record anywhere in America of anybody ever dying of a protein deficiency. It's just, you know, it can't happen. But if people, if their bodies have adapted to throwing off all that excess protein, and overnight they become vegetarian, the body's still throwing off that protein, they can end up with protein deficiency problems. And so, you know,
that's
transitioning is important.
Wow. Thanks for the lesson. Yeah.
Delighted and honored. And I'm so delighted,
Michael,
to hear about your grandson.
Thanks. One last teeny question on the dietary side. I love feta cheese. I get it from sheep's milk. Is that any better than cow's milk?
2,000%. And actually, there's no such thing as cow's milk feta. I'm actually kind of surprised. Feta cheese means sheep from a goat cheese from a goat or a sheep. That's what feta means. And I'm surprised that the feta industry, when farmers started coming in and say, well, we're going to change the way we make our cheese and we're going to call this feta too, that they didn't shut them down and block them from doing that, because there is no such thing as cow's milk feta. I know you can go to every grocery store and there's a package labeled and, you know, feta, and it'll start out and say pasteurized milk. That's not feta cheese. It just is not. But it's slipping under the radar, and most everybody thinks it is. But, yeah, the protein molecule, actually cow's milk, or pardon me, goat's milk and sheep's milk, are, if you look at that molecule, it's almost the same as a human mother's milk. And so the products that come from it are a lot closer to human. Now, if you've got a body that is going to start out and come out of the animal at about, you know, 60 or so pounds, and you expect it to be 1,000 pounds within a year, you better get it lots and lots and lots of cow's milk. I mean, that's what it's designed for. Take a look around at the size of the bodies that are surviving on cow's milk. And they're following the pattern. It's great. You got a 60-pound body. You want to grow to a 1,000-pound body within a year? There it is. Cow's milk's perfect. But, you know, I mean, we're the only animal that you will find in all of the creation that goes around sucking on the tit of another animal and eating their bodily fluids. And, you know, there's no animal on the earth that even eats the bodily fluids of their own species after they reach maturity. You know, there's a place for it. There's a reason for it. There are things there to cause building and growth, you know, fat content and protein content and immunity, all sorts of things. And cow's milk is just perfect and great for cows. But if you look at its structure, it's nothing like, you know, the fat content such of mother's milk. Sheep and goat are pretty close.
So...
yeah, and we eat actual feta cheese too. We can't really buy it anywhere here, but when we travel, you know, within a couple hour radius and we're going through a city, I'll come back with half a dozen blocks of feta cheese, actual feta from sheep.
That is
one of the best places. One of the best places to buy it.
Which is one of the best places?
Trader Joe's.
Trader Joe's. Yeah, Costco has wonderful, Okay. Thank you, Michael.
And Costco and Sam's have a wonderful goat cheese, too. Both of them have a really nice goat cheese that we really enjoy. It's a like a almost like a cream cheese kind of goat cheese. It's really good.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And we use that pretty regularly. That's what goes on our tomato sandwiches once we pick them off the vine and slice them and want to put them on toast.
Yum. Yum.
It is yum.
All
for
right.
Sure. All right, young lady. Well, we appreciate you and certainly hold space for you and that young man, all those young men you're working with. It's pretty interesting that it's primarily the males in your family that are coming to you for support and healing. That's pretty sweet.
Mm. Yeah, that's a nice thought. They're good boys, all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet. Well, let's join in the commitment to remove from the family system the traumas that these young men have had imposed on them from generations of interaction with fathers who were brutal.
Yeah.
And bring back the experience and the presence of love to them.
Right. Amen.
What a gift to give the world. A man and a woman.
Yeah.
All right. Any other thoughts for you today?
No, I'm going to sign off and listen to the rest of the show.
All right. We appreciate you. Cherish you.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay. Blessings. Bye-bye. All right. Well, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody out there on the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room? And thank you for that conversation.
Do you have a hand?
Susan? Oh, well, let's say hello.
Okay. It's Magda 828. You're on the air.
Welcome,
hello.
Young lady.
Thank you very much. I have been thoroughly enjoying the conversation between you and Susan. Nice to hear you. Susan, oh, excuse me. I get a tickle. Be right back.
Okay. So it brings up annoyance when that happens, doesn't it? Like, oh, can't get rid of this silly thing. Give me water.
I just have some water, so let's see if this works. Okay, I'll be back.
Go for it.
I'm going to try again. Okay. So what you guys were just talking about toward the end,
right.
Of course, reminded me of something that I learned years and years and years ago from a therapist I was seeing, and I was complaining to her about how compulsive I was being about getting custard. You'll appreciate this, being ice cream lovers. I grew up in Milwaukee, and we had custard stands. So it's even rich ice cream, yeah. And so she gave me a couple of clues. She said, well, different emotions will bring up the desire to use different drugs. And I don't actually remember how the emotions and the drugs went together. But one of the drugs was sugar. And another drug was caffeine was another one.
Right.
And nicotine was another. And I'm not sure if there were any more.
Casomorphine, milk. That's a powerful drug. The morphine in milk is very powerful. And very addictive.
Yeah, maybe so. And so what I started to do after that, once I got clued into that, was to watch when I had these incredible cravings what I was craving and what I was feeling at that time. And then I would do some sort of work. I don't remember what I was doing then to explore what those feelings were generated from, you know, what the trigger had been. And it was pretty darn successful. So I'm surprised that I ever forgot that little trick. And what I'm just thinking right now is that it would be helpful for me again to notice when I am definitely having a craving that I must have some of this or I must have some of that. Oh, salt was another one. Yeah. I think the best thing for me to do is to stop everything if I can, depending upon where I am and what I'm doing, and sit down and do a worksheet over the feeling that I have, and it will then be revealed about, you know, where that came from. What I really liked, too, about what she said was very gentle. She said, you know, if you have these cravings, go ahead and find out what that's coming from. Find out what your feeling is and then what it's coming from. And then do your work around that. And if you still want to have a piece of this or a cone or whatever, go ahead. And I found that I rarely ever still want that thing that had been so terrorizing me before. So I just plugged that in for myself, and maybe Susan or anybody else might find it useful. Stop, do the worksheet, investigate, do the worksheet, and then, okay, if you still want that candy bar, go get it.
Yeah, be gentle with yourself. For sure.
Right.
That's important.
And another permission that I was given was when you decide to do it, to eat it, to consume it, whatever it is, enjoy it 100%.
Enjoy it to the max.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because if we're downing it with guilt, it's not really fun. And there also might be some concomitant physical energy that's getting stuck because of that guilt.
Right.
Yeah.
And just being conscious, you know, doing any behavior and being conscious about it, even if it's something that the party says, I don't want to do this, being conscious is going to begin the transmutation of that drive, whatever's underneath it, for sure.
Yes.
Sounds like you had a good therapist.
Yeah, she was pretty terrific. Unfortunately, she moved to a different state. So I didn't get to continue working with her, but I did get a lot out of our time together.
Sounds like someone that might be worth looking up and just dropping a note and letting her know you're thinking about her and appreciating her.
Oh, what a good idea. Thank
you.
You
who knows? You never know what somebody might be ready to hear and what kind of a difference you can make by giving that gift.
Yeah, lovely. That's lovely.
And with all of the Zoom things going on, you know, a lot of therapists are doing Zoom meetings now instead of in person. I know Michelle's down in Mexico right now, and she's doing that with her clients. So get back in touch with her and Zoom with her.
Good idea. All right. Lovely. I was just remembering that when I have felt that kind of compulsion about I really need to put this in my mouth, it's something that goes in and satisfies me temporarily, ever so temporarily, with my taste buds. But when I have had those times when I just have to keep grabbing it, chewing it, swallowing it, grab, chew, swallow, the idea of stopping, you know, and saying, wait a minute, let me do this first, and then I can come back and resume. I don't know. That'll be kind of interesting to experience. I mean, that's...
Well, you know, as we wake up, you know, bringing self love to conscious awareness is, you know, a major key in the healing process and transmuting those lower energies that become, tend to become cravings.
Yes. Yes. And when I'm, pretty clear that I have been doing my work, addressing my emotional stuff, whatever it might be, I don't have the cravings, period.
Right.
It always amazes
yep.
me, like, oh, I would have killed for this yesterday and today. I really don't care. You know?
Yep.
So
progress.
That's the reason. Yeah, and that's the reason I'm saying this so I can hear myself say it. That's the reason to continue doing the cleansing that the worksheets provide the opportunity for on a regular basis, not only
right.
when I'm in need. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and go back and remember in Laws of Living the discussion about regulatory speech. How does regulatory yeah. speech become that which regulates our behavior? First, we hear mm-hmm. the conversation. We hear the words. Then
mm-hmm.
the words are used to oneself out loud. They start to speak it. Then they become silent speech. We speak it to ourselves internally, and along that pathway, if the behaviors involved in or brought forward by those words are experienced to reduce stress, then it's going to proceed into the unconscious, and it's going to become habit.
Yes.
And if it's, if we find that the habit is not one that's serving us, then you do the reverse. You consciously, purposely reverse the process, edge it out, acknowledge it, speak it, and speak the fact that you're ready to be finished with this and let it go. And, you know, it's that speech is such a key part of the whole process.
Right. And that's what I was just thinking as you were explaining that. Okay, if I want to let go of something, I need to do the reverse step. Yeah. So can you give an example of what that might look like?
You mean speech going into someone's system?
Coming out, doing the reverse.
Well, let's look at the kid. I mean, children are born created in the essence and the image of love, and that's the truth about who they are. The child mm-hmm. who's told, you're bad, you'll never be any good, at some point starts to speak to themselves and think of themselves in their silent speech as, I'm no good. I'll never be any good. I'm not worthy. I'm not deserving. I'm ugly.
Right.
I'm, you know, whatever that is. And so the child who's been told that, the child who behaves, or, you know, the adult, somebody offers the adult a compliment. What does the adult do? Oh, you know, no, you don't have to. No, don't. I don't deserve that. You don't have to do that. Rather than
right.
saying thank you. So the motion from, if someone's there to support them, say, well, I noticed that, you know, one of the things you really crave is attention and a compliment. But when the attention and the compliment comes, I notice that you push it away. Have you noticed that? So now they've heard that speech. Then they might say, well, gee, you know, I never thought of myself as pushing away when I say, oh, don't compliment me like that. And, yeah, I do like to get compliments. But then, yeah, I've noticed I do push away. So now I'm bringing that to back forward in speech. And I'm negating that speech. Yeah, I see how that doesn't really work. So
mm-hmm.
what am I going to do now? Oh, now the speech is going to become, so in the future when somebody compliments me, I'm just going to say thank you. Now, the next time somebody's sitting at the desk and somebody compliments them, they're probably not going to speak out loud and say, oh, yeah, I'll accept that compliment. But it's probably going to be, yeah, I can just receive that and say thank you. And now the whole speech
mm-hmm.
system's changed. And when a compliment comes, mm-hmm. rather than talking to themselves about how bad and evil and wrong they are and blah, 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 it's like, oh, thank you. They've changed
mm-hmm.
the whole speech system.
Okay.
And the show's about to cut us off.
Yeah.
So have a blessed day. All right. Let's
and
go. Good. Blessings.
You
okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
I choose to live more consciously.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pache, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.